For decades, major museums and collectors generally fended off charges that many of their fabulous antiquities were acquired illegally, but the winds have changed. Marion True, once the highly respected curator of antiquities at the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles, is on trial in Italy for conspiracy to smuggle recently uncovered treasures out of that country and onto the Getty's display cases. Earlier this year, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City agreed to return to Italy a Greek vase known as the Euphronios Crater. The Met paid $1 million for that vase back in 1972 and until this year always denied Italian claims. Egypt wants the St. Louis Museum to return a 3,200-year-old mummy mask it bought in 1998, believing that it had left Egypt back in the 1950s. Egypt says it was stolen from a storage site near an archaeological dig in the 1990s. The issues are more than academic. Who owns cultural property? Do artifacts belong to the modern-day countries where ancient civilizations once thrived? Should there be a statute of limitations? Does a hot antiquities market lead to more looting? Later in the program, thoroughbred horse racing. As usual, there's talk of a super horse as Baltimore prepares for the Preakness Stakes this weekend. Andy Beyer handicaps the hype. But first, if you have questions about how antiquities get from an ancient ruin to a big city museum, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is talk@npr.org. Ralph Framolino is staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize with reporter Jason Felch on their coverage of the antiquities scandal at the Getty Museum. He's with us now from the studios at the LA Times. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And how serious is this case against a former Getty curator, Marion True?
Well, it's fairly serious, and at least the Italians are very serious about getting a conviction. One of her co-conspirators in the trial, and she has two, one of her co-conspirators has already been convicted and assessed one of the largest fines ever in an antiquities case. He's appealing his conviction, and they're using much of the same evidence against Marion True.
And it seems this controversy has spread to academia as well. NYU got a $200 million gift from a controversial source, and now some people at least have resigned, saying that if they accept this, they're agreeing with practices that are illegal.
Yes, cultural property is becoming the third rail in many what used to be very pocket kind of concerns, archaeology, museum world, but it sort of reflects, I think, the larger globalization that we see in economics. We're finding source countries that used to be the providers, cheap providers of some very fabulous cultural property, now saying, no, wait a minute, we want to control that. We want to control our own cultural destiny. And a lot of the consumers, the Western nations in particular, are now being faced with demands to return things that they, well, arguably knew were hot.
Mm-hmm. Which countries in particular are affected?
The source countries are Italy, Greece, Turkey. You're looking at China now. There's a lot coming out of China and Southeast Asia. And, of course, Mesoamerica. We're talking about Peru, which recently sued one of the museums in the East, and the name escapes me, for returns of a return of an object. So those are the source countries now. And then the consumer countries are the United States, Great Britain, France, the Western countries, and also Japan.
And one of the things that I guess a lot of people have a hard time believing is antiquities, this was all dug up years and years ago. It was Troy. We all remember that. But this stuff keeps coming up.
Neil, the whole issue of antiquities goes back to when the first army made its first conquered its first civilization. Antiquities or trophies, artwork were always trophies, and they were brought back. If you can't bring back the head of your enemy, you bring back an obelisk. What's happened is, starting in the 1970s, there has been a gradual, and now it's gotten to a point where it's a sea change. It's almost, you talk about tsunami, it's a tsunami in this area, where the countries around the world recognized that there was a lot of looting going on, there was a lot of illicit trading, and this wasn't fair. This wasn't fair for the cultural integrity of the countries that were being ripped off. So a movement started with UNESCO in the 1970s. There was a convention that has been signed now by 109 countries in which they say we are going to respect our colleagues and what their laws say. If Italy says you dig this up after 1939, it is the government's and it's therefore our property. We respect that. Mm-hmm. And that has then come together with a lot more push on the part of source countries to exercise their rights. Mexico has done this. Italy has done this. Turkey has done this, where they have filed either civil suits in the United States or they have asked the federal government through the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty to help them recover, help them bring criminal cases against people who were involved in the chain that brought looted antiquities to rest in museums and private collections here.
And one of the things that some people are asking about, as well you know, is there a statute of limitations? After all, that euphronious crater that was found in Italy, originally from Greece, how'd they get it?
Well, that's true. And that's why the people within this realm are – the debate now is not so much should we do this, but what is the date we should have that would be sort of like the date where we'll say, okay, after this date now, we're going to really start enforcing these laws. Many people who are sort of hardliners within the archaeological community say 1972. That is the date. If you have anything, if you acquired anything after 1972 and you don't know its ownership history or provenance, it's looted. Others, the Getty, when they here, they made their decision that 1995 would be the date that they would enforce this. And there, recently, as I understand it, Switzerland has come out with a brand new law saying, as of now. From now on. And so essentially grandfathers in all these other objects, and it does away with these arguments that, well, you know, if we give the Euphronius crater back, we're going to have to empty our entire collection because it's all ultimately looted. So this now is the debate that's going on. Where do we draw the line? Because people are now recognizing a line needs to be drawn.
Let's get a listener involved in the conversation. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. This is Dave. Dave's calling from South Lyon in Michigan.
Yes. Actually, the gentleman just answered my question about the antiquities that are already in museums, whether or not they would get taken away.
And it remains to be seen, I think, is still the answer. But isn't that Ralph Framolino, isn't that really the question that's pending, in a way, in this trial in Italy?
Well, this trial in Italy is unique. And it's unique because for the first time, the Italians were able to get pretty hard evidence that the things that they're looking at – and by the way, it's not just the Getty. There are other museums now that are on the hook for this material because it went through a major supplier, Giacomo Medici is his name, and went through his warehouse. But what they were able to do is they got photographs. They've got 4,000 photographs or Polaroids of these objects as they appear, as they came out of the ground. Things like at the Getty Museum, there's a photograph of this wonderful table footing of griffins eating a fallen doe. Well, it's all broken up and it's wrapped up in an Italian paper and newspaper, and it's in a car trunk. Well, that's obviously looted. And so they were able to use this and to trace it to the Getty and to present what they think and are arguing is irrefutable proof. And this has really kind of galvanized the movement by source countries. And through technology and being able to trace things to through the internet, they were able to trace things to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, which this week is going to Italy for discussions about repatriating objects, to Princeton, which this week is going back to Italy. They traced it to New York, and we know about what the Met did. They traced it to the Getty. We're talking about museums in Toledo, Cleveland, Minneapolis. So we've just started to see some of the dominoes falling in this cultural patrimony debate.
Dave, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And let's go to Neil. Neil calling from San Francisco.
Yeah, well, you know, there's an argument on the other side that most of these source countries were notoriously indifferent to their art, history, archaeology, and all the rest until fairly recently, and that the Western archaeologists who went in and found these things and dug them up and all that were really saving them from the terrible neglect and indifference. In fact, in ancient Rome, in medieval Rome, and even in early modern Rome, they were using the marble columns from the Forum for tearing them down and using them for new buildings. And so I think this is, and today, to this day, the Islamic countries, by and large, there may be some exceptions like Turkey, are antagonistic to their ancient civilizations. For example, it was the Greeks who built many of those great, beautiful cities in Turkey, and the Islamic people have no interest in that stuff at all. The Egyptians don't care about the pyramids, essentially. Obviously, some do, but the majority don't. So we're saving, by bringing these things to the West, we're actually saving them, and we're seriously studying them, and in many cases.
Let's give Ralph Framolino a chance to respond, because we're running short on time, Neil.
Well, there are really good points that this listener is bringing up, and that's in fact true. I mean, Italy itself, which is bringing this criminal prosecution, they stole obelisks from Ethiopia. So they had to one of the things they had to do is return one of the obelisks back to Ethiopia, because they were bringing charges against the Getty and these other museums. I mean, nobody's hands are clean. And yes, you're right. These nations have neglected this in the past, and museums do have a legitimate question about – I mean, we're not hiding this stuff. It's out in glass showcases. And
Hello?
I'm afraid we don't have time, Neil.
I'm
afraid we don't have time, because we're running out of the break. And, in fact, we have to say goodbye to Ralph Framolino as well, a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, who was kind enough to join us from that newspaper's radio studios today. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back after the break. If you'd like to join us again, the number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Who owns the artifacts that are pulled from the ground? Should museums have to give them back after having them for many years? I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Several American museums have recently been asked to return some of their prized antiquities. Greece and Italy have both pressed museum directors to hand over pieces they say were stolen, looted, and sold to the highest bidder. If you have questions about how these artifacts are found, how they find their way into museums, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. At our website, npr.org, you can read about the 1995 raid on suspected Tomb Raider Giacomo Medici's warehouse in Geneva and see some of the vases, frescoes, and other antiquities that police found there. How do those objects, though, get from the site of an ancient ruin to our museums? Peter Watson writes about this in his new book, The Medici Conspiracy, The Illicit Journey of Looted Antiquities from Italy's Tomb Raiders to the World's Greatest Museums. He's with us now from the studios at the BBC's Broadcasting House in London. Very nice of you to join us today on the program.
Good evening.
And that name, Giacomo Medici, is coming up a lot in this program already. He was already convicted in this ongoing trial in Rome.
Yes, he got, as Ralph Framolino was saying, he got 10 years and a $12 million fine, though under the Italian system he's appealing. But it's the largest sentence ever carried out, because he was the major figure in a wide network of people, and he was the sort of centre of the web. Everything went through him in his warehouse in Switzerland, and by a series of accidents and clever investigations, the Italians got onto him in 1995 and found 4,000 objects in his warehouse, and lots of photographs and documents, mm-hmm. which have led to the current trial in Rome and his own trial, which was ended in 2004.
But how do these objects find their way out of the ground and into Mr. Medici's warehouse?
Well, one of the things that was found in the course of the investigations was a piece of paper which the Italians call the organigram, which was a layout of the network this underground network, and this shows the series of tomb robbers scattered around Italy and how they bring the objects to Mr. Medici, who has a house north of Rome, and he was responsible for buying them from the tomb robbers and then transporting them to the warehouse in Switzerland. And at that time, of course, over the past 20 or 30 years, once they are smuggled into Switzerland, so far as Swiss law was concerned, it was then quite legal to export them. And they went out through auction houses, mainly Sotheby's in London, and to collectors around the world and to museums in Germany, Denmark, Japan, America, Britain and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And if you think that this was a process whereby, famous pieces are put on the market, there are examples of walls, entire walls uncovered in Pompeii that were smashed into easily smugglable bits. You also report in the book on vases, these ancient vases that were smashed and then shipped in little bits so that they could be put together back at a museum in Los Angeles.
That's right, and it's an answer to one of the earlier questions that people are preserving these objects. I mean, this is, quite frankly, moonshine. During the course of our investigations, we came across one excavation, in quotation marks, which was being carried out by a mechanical digger in the south of Italy in the dead of night. Now, this was destroying as much as it was finding, and the excavation referred to was a villa found near Pompeii, south of Naples. And the photographs were taken by the tomb robber of the walls of this villa in situ. They were very, very beautifully painted frescoes. And the room was partially covered with what are called lapilli, which are small balls of volcanic ash, which formed when Vesuvius erupted. And these are shown in the photograph and therefore identify it as coming from that area. And what then happens, and this is shown in the photographs, is that these walls are detached from the villa. They're broken up into laptop-sized pieces. The photographs are in the book. They are then transported by truck from near to Naples to Switzerland. And we see them in the photographs laid out on the restorer's table like a giant jigsaw. The pieces are put back together in the right order, but photographed before they're joined up. Then they're photographed again after they are joined up. I mean, this is barbarism on a major scale.
Let's get a listener involved. This is Daryl. Daryl calling us from St. Louis.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a fascinating conversation. I'm in the wine business, and I represent one of the estates that's owned by the Medici's, and this Giacomo is a distant cousin. But I was with gentleman named Roberto Stucchi, whose mother is Lorenza de' Medici. She's the foremost authority on Etruscan culture. And he has this winery that was built in the early 11th century. And I was there, and I noticed this clay urn on his shelf. And he said, yeah, he found it when he was a kid. And he started telling me about northern Tuscany, that it's just, there's tombs everywhere up there. It's an archaeological masterpiece. And he found that he and his friends used to play. They'd go with a screen and a shovel, and they would just sift through the soil, and he found it as like a 10-year-old boy playing on the family property. And that's when he started discussing Tumbaroli. And he told me about what happens, that you could be a farmer that might be growing, let's say, potatoes, and you start finding shards. Well, you're a potato farmer. You don't want your property to be seized by the government, so you hire so they can do a proper archaeological dig. So they hire these Tumbaroli, and they come in with bobcats and high-voltage lighting, and they come in at 2 in the morning, and they excavate it, for lack of a better word, and just yank everything out of there so the farmer could go back to farming his property, and the state knows nothing about it.
Peter Watson, does that sound familiar?
It sounds very familiar. We have got the records in the book of a Tumbaroli who was a sort of manic about keeping records, and he kept a diary of what he found where and how much he sold each pot or vase for, and included in the costs were he would pay rent to the person who owned the land in order to have the privilege of digging there, and that person would also get a share of the proceeds. So, yes, it sounds very familiar.
Additionally, on this property at Badia Cotabono, an 11th century property, and underneath one of their vineyards, they discovered a 5th century ruin. So I guess how old things are is very relative when you look at it like this.
Yeah, I guess, Daryl.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask Peter Watson, but the other part of the story, is that farmer right in fearing that, in fact, if he finds some shards in his field, the government is going to seize his land and spend years doing an archaeological dig, and what's more, that anything they find, it isn't his, it's the government's?
Well, in Italy, you can legally keep things so long as you inform the government, so it's not quite so draconian as that. And most of the areas where the archaeologists are looking are now specified archaeological sites. But yes, there's no getting away from the fact that in all the Mediterranean countries, not just Italy, but you go to Cyprus, you scratch the ground and you're as likely to find something as not. Same is true with Turkey. These were, you know, major civilizations. And, you know, we can't go overboard here. You know, you can't come down on everybody. But obviously, when major finds are discovered, it's natural to want to excavate them properly to find out just how important it was and how much it can tell us. Mm-hmm. I mean, take, for example, the Euphronius crater that you referred to. Now, until the Euphronius crater appeared, no vase by Euphronius had been found for about 140 years.
A famous Greek artist, yes.
That's right. We call him the Michelangelo of classical Greece, if you like. But he... since then, rather, there have been another four Euphronius vases have turned up. Three of them, we know, have passed through the hands of Mr. Medici. Now, the possibility is quite strong that these all came from the same tomb or villa or repository of one kind or another. Now, since he was such an important and famous artist in his day, had those vases, if they were found together, been excavated in a proper way, then obviously that would be a tremendous discovery that we would all want to go and see when we visit Italy next. But, of course, we never get the chance with looting.
Hmm. Daryl, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. The concern of archaeologists and source countries where artifacts are found is understandable. So is the dilemma faced by museums and institutions around the world. After all, not all objects are acquired illegally. In 2002, the directors of 19 museums, including the Metropolitan and Getty, signed a declaration on the importance and value of universal museums. James Cuno is president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago. He was one of the signers, and he joins us now from his office in Chicago. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much.
The declaration affirms the need to discourage illegal traffic in antiquities. It also argues there should be some sort of statute of limitation, some date after which or before which no claims will be recognized. In your mind, how would that work?
Well, I think there are a couple of things about this. One is that no one condones the illicit excavation or digging and therefore looting of archaeological sites. That we all agree that we want to preserve archaeological sites and the information contained therein.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, no one condones criminal activity. What is critical, however, and what needs to be addressed, and what is always the bone of contention, is what to do when one is offered an object already alienated from its find spot, as they say, already removed from that excavation or that site, not the excavation, but found by the farmer in the field kind of thing, or the looter in the field, whatever it might be. What's the museum to do with that object? And some of us feel that should there be... This is an object with incomplete or no provenance. Should we turn our back on it? If we turn our back on it, where does it go and to what purpose does it serve? And some of us think that there ought to be, within reasonable limits, the opportunity to acquire that object, because just as you were talking most recently about the Euphronius crater, its whereabouts was made known by the fact that the museum acquired it, the Metropolitan acquired it. So there's an advantage to acquiring, to study, preserving, collecting these things, presenting them to the public, and presenting them to the public in the context of a universal museum, which has the opportunity for comparisons between Mediterranean cultures, Asian cultures, Mesoamerican cultures, in which one can see relationships between cultures and not just distinctions between cultures.
I've also understand that, in fact, even though an object may be removed from its archaeological context, that doesn't mean it's archaeologically valueless.
Some will say that an object with no provenance, that is, outside of an archaeological site, is meaningless, and of course that's not true. Any number of things that have been important to us have no provenance, no archaeological context to speak of, and among them one has, for example, the oracle bones in China. These are bones that were found in medicinal shops in the early part of the 20th century. therefore without provenance, no archaeological site or context for them. But nevertheless, they're the means by which we were able to verify the existence of the earliest known Chinese dynasty. Equally true with cuneiform tablets, much of what we know about the ancient Near East is from those tablets, and those tablets are most often without provenance, and certainly the Dead Sea Scrolls are that way. Now, that's true, what I just said, in each of those cases, those are objects that have language on them.
Mm-hmm.
They're textual objects, so they're objects that can tell us things independent of their content, of their find spot. But there are certainly things like that that are important.
We're talking with James Cuno, President and Director of the Art Institute of Chicago, and with Peter Watson, author most recently of The Medici Conspiracy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And James Cuno, I have to say, at this point, are you checking the provenance of every object, every antiquity in your collection?
We're certainly checking the provenance of those that seem to be problematic. That is, that those that are associated with people who have proven over time to be associated with problematic acquisitions. So we're looking at those, and then with every acquisition, potential acquisition, we look at them fiercely. That is, that we, together with our curators and lawyers, talk with the dealers, searching provenance. It takes months. We're enormously careful about it.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a listener on the line. This is David. David calling from Salem, Oregon.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment really didn't have anything to do with the provenance. It had to do with an earlier caller that you had who mentioned that many artifacts are actually, well, you could call it looted, but you could easily as well say that educated, intelligent, trained people were able to save them and bring them to places where they could study them adequately and where they could keep them safe. I'd like to really speak strongly to the opposite side of that. I lived in a small town in Colombia, in a town called San Agustin, for many years. The valley of San Agustin is full of sites where there are large stone statues, and there's an archaeological park full of these large stone statues as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about the fact that there are places in the world that are dangerous or that have governments that aren't stable or the situation isn't stable, we're ignoring the fact that looking at life as made up of governments and political situations is really only one way of looking at things. There are people who live in this valley of San Agustin, and anyone who's been there and knows this place knows that the people in that valley have a fierce love of their statues, and they're very proud of their statues that were made by the people who lived before them on their very land in the valley where they live. In 1929, a German archaeologist took away a large stash of the statues from San Agustin to Berlin because he was a luminary of the archaeological world in Berlin. And, of course, Colombia was out at the end of nowhere, and he was able to get these statues to a place where he believed that they would be kept safe and could be studied. Can you imagine what's happened to Berlin since 1929, as opposed to the peaceful countryside of San Agustin? He took them exactly to the center of the maelstrom. Now, when I went there to study these statues, there were already a number of them missing, of course. And in any case, the really important point for people to understand is this. Out of the 34 statues that Preuss took back to Berlin, there are 21 of them that can now be accounted for down in their warehouses. And you'll only get to see those warehouses if you're able to produce the type of credentials that they respect.
Yeah.
There are only three of them on display there, and the people of San Agustin would appreciate them in the true Universal Museum, which would be in their original sites back in the countryside of Colombia.
And let's give James Cuno a chance to respond to David's question.
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that we can't generalize upon these things and to say that what's true of Colombia isn't true of Greece or Turkey or Egypt, for that matter. Or true of Iraq or Afghanistan. We have to take them case by case, not only in terms of the relative abundance of things remaining in those countries, but the relative stability in those countries and the relative importance of seeing those objects elsewhere in the world, not only in those countries. I would argue that in the spirit of the Universal Museum, in contradiction with your caller, is that it's important, certainly, to have some representation of these things in the place from which they come. It's equally important to have them elsewhere in the world so that people elsewhere in the world can see them, and not only them, but them in relationship to, as I said earlier, comparative examples of other cultures. And what museums today understand is what museums understood earlier in the 20th century, is that we're all for scientific excavation of archaeological sites. What we're equally for is shared access to that material. And previously, in the first part of the 20th century, There was a practice of something called partage, by which the excavating team shared in the finds with the host country and returned to Berlin, to London, to Paris, to Chicago, to New York, to Boston, with a portion of those objects for further study and for greater appreciation by other peoples in the world. So it's really about shared access and about scientific excavation and about preservation.
James Cuno, thank you very much. I know you're busy. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
James Cuno, president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago, with us from his office there in Illinois. More on this point when we come back from a short break. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In a few minutes, racing towards the Triple Crown, horse racing's Preakness is this weekend. All eyes are on Barbaro and Pimlico. But first, the trade in looted antiquities. Our guest is Peter Watson, author of The Medici Conspiracy, The Illicit Journey of Looted Antiquities from Italy's Tomb Raiders to the World's Greatest Museums. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Rudy. Rudy's calling us from Clarksville, Tennessee.
Yes, sir. I was wondering if museums get a lot of their pieces from private collectors, what would be the implications of, you know, more restrictive international laws on private collections that may be donated to museums? Would these pieces then be relegated to the black market, where they're bought, sold, and traded, and never see the light of day?
Mm-hmm. Peter Watson, that mechanism, as you describe it in your book, is a very important one.
Yes, I think, but the likelihood is that the opposite would occur, because I think that's what the Italians' plan is at the moment. I mean, it's very, very difficult, if you're trying to crack down on this trade, to chase all the thousands of tomb robbers in one country and catch them and punish them. What you do instead is you try to close down the market, the illicit market. So you put pressure on the collectors. And you put pressure first on the museums, which is what is happening now, not to acquire unprovenanced objects, either from directly from the market or from collectors who normally donate to museums either for tax breaks or for the sort of intellectual and social prestige that it brings. And far from this going any more underground, I mean, let us not forget that it is already hugely underground, and the process that's now we're now in the middle of with this trial is trying to stop this by approaching the market countries, shaming them into stopping this by doing what the Italians are doing now, by bringing people to trial and showing the ins and outs of how the traffic in this world actually works and the damage that it does. And never forget that the people who make the money here, the big money, are the middlemen, the people who bring it from Switzerland to America, from Switzerland to Denmark, from Switzerland to Japan. It's not the small people on the ground who make any real money here.
And Rudy, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And it's part of your argument that, in fact, this museums, yes, but collectors, too, have driven up an enormously hot market in antiquities that in fact, is spurring even more looting.
Yes. I mean, I think the point to recognize, two points I'd like to make. One is that people on my side of the argument are not against objects of antiquity being in all the museums around the world. We think that that is right. There is a kind of museum of mankind, if you like. What we are against is the illicit looting and how best to stop that. And I think that it is the way the Italians are proceeding is a more effective way than chasing the Tombaroli. Now, the Euphronius crater that we keep coming back to, why that is so important, is that in 1972, when the Met acquired it, it paid $1 million for it. And it was a real headline price, the price of an Impressionist painting. Up to that point, no antiquity had sold for more than, I think, $125,000. And various people said that similar objects were on the market for as little as $25,000. So in paying this, in overpaying by such a large amount for this eye-catching crater, there is a sense in which the Met created a market. The people in Italy went crazy when they heard this and redoubled and retripled their efforts to find objects. So there is a direct link between the money and the looting.
We should say, of course, Tom Baroli, the Italian word for basically tomb raiders. I think that's right. And here's finally an email question from Mark in Little Rock. My former employer has a very large collection of ancient Native American artifacts, which I suspect are stolen. Who do I contact to turn them in? I feel as if these items rightfully belong to the tribes they were stolen from.
Well, there is, I've forgotten his name now, but there is a police force in the American National Parks organization which takes on this responsibility. So that's not a very perhaps close definition, but I'm sure your caller will know all about the American National Parks. Mm-hmm. And under that rubric, you'll find their investigative unit.
Okay, he can probably find the Park Service at gov.org. Anyway, he can find it through the Park Service. Anyway, and finally, I just wanted to clarify, though, that Native American antiquities, they are part of this as well?
Well, yes, they are. I mean, the point is, if they are smuggled out of America, then yes, they are. I mean, Britain is in the same dilemma in the sense that we are a market country. We, you know, the auction houses deal in illicit material from Greece and Italy and Egypt and so forth. But we also have our own Roman history, our own Stone Age history, and things are found. But we have what many people think is the most sensible of all laws, and that is if you find an object on your land, you take it to the British Museum, which will give you put a market value on it. And then the museum can either buy it from you for that value if they think it's important, or you're free to sell it or to keep it. And this so far works well, but it doesn't entirely stop smuggling because, you know, the British Museum is not flush with funds, so its market valuations tend to be on the low side, and people often think that they can get more by smuggling it abroad. But that is a law that I know many people on both sides of the argument think might be another way forward.
Sounds like Antiquities Roadshow, almost. And where are we on the debate over this the so-called statute of limitation? Should it be 1972, 1995, today?
Well, I think most archaeologists would go for 1972 because, firstly, you can't go back throughout history. I mean, it would just be chaotic. And where would you stop? It has to be somewhere fairly modern. And so most archaeologists, I think, would go for that. They tend to think that the more modern dates are too recent. But let us face it, this area of looted antiquities is a little bit like ivory poaching, smoking. You know, attitudes and morals are evolving. And so long as the game is improving, then that's a good thing, I think.
Peter Watson, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Peter Watson's new book is Medici Conspiracy, The Illicit Journey of Looted Antiquities from Italy's Tomb Raiders to the World's Greatest Museums. He joined us today from the BBC's broadcasting house in London. And just a moment, Barbaro's run for the Triple Crown.